Good morning, everybody. My name is Joe Heffner, and I am an alcoholic. Our topic is First Things First in this. If you're not here for that, you probably are in the wrong room, and if you are, you're in the right place. So, there are special needs seating section for those exclusively who are in some way handicapped. And I'm not sure where they are, but they're clearly marked, I'm sure. So, can we have a moment of silence and gratitude for AA's recoveries for the past 70 years, followed by the Serenity Prayer? My name is Joe, and my home group is a Belt Valley group in Belt, Montana. And how a drunk can get from where I was to where I am is beyond me, but thank you all. At this time, I'll introduce our first speaker, Ed D. from Herndon, Virginia.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Ed. I'm an alcoholic. For some reason, this is an older crowd, but I had this urge to say, what up, yo? You know. First of all, I want to thank my higher power for giving me this opportunity. I don't know why I'm here, except that I'm a drunk, something to that effect. I'd like to thank Doug, the chairperson of the convention. Thank my sponsor, Frank. If I don't do that, I'll get a phone call, I'm sure. I want to thank all of you for allowing me the opportunity to come into this room and be a part of you. You've kept me alive. Thank you very much. And I also want to congratulate Canada on Canada Day. Congratulations. Last winter, I'm from the D.C. area, and if we get a couple flakes, we panic. And last winter, we had 2 inches, and I was driving on a back road, and I was 2 cars behind this woman in a van, a minivan, and she had 4 kids in the car, and she started to go up the hill on Lawyers Road, if you know the area, and she got stuck about a third of the way up, and she kept spinning her wheels. And she wasn't getting anywhere. So some of us got out of our car and told her to stop, to slowly back down, and we'd help her. No, I'll get this. And she kept spinning her wheels. And nothing we said could get her to stop spinning her wheels. Finally, she spun them so much that her tire caught fire. And then the whole van exploded. We had to get the kids out of the car, but luckily nobody was hurt. But that's the attitude I get sometimes when I don't put first things first. When I try to take back control and do things my way, I'll get this, I swear, I'll get this, watch this. And it never works. No matter what I said to her, no matter what the other people said to her, she wouldn't stop trying to get her van up by spinning her wheels. She destroyed her whole van in the process. If you're like me, the longer you stay around here, and this is my experience, the longer you stay in AA, you're going to have either traumas or significant events that come into your life that will test that concept of first things first. Now, what first things first means to me is a little twist. It means that I need to retrace the steps I took to establish my connection with the higher power. When I lose my spiritual connection, I lose me. When I lose my spirituality and my personality, I'm like one of the walking dead. And some of the things that happened to me in my recovery were this. I got out of a rehab, and I went to rehab for 18 months. I guess I was pretty bad and patient. When I finally got out, I lasted 6 months to a year before I relapsed, because I had in the back of my head, one day I'll show you, you're all wrong and I'm right. And what happened was, it was just the opposite. You were right and I was wrong. And the next morning after my relapse, I went into the room and I sat in a corner and I cried. Because you were right. And I didn't want you to be right. 6 months after that, and you may laugh at this, but I had this girl, and I moved into a college campus, by the way, and I had this girl who followed me everywhere. She knew my schedule of classes. She knew when I went to the cafeteria. She knew what time I got out of my room, went to the elevator, walked. She knew everything. Everywhere I went, she was there. When I would go to the cafeteria, she would sit opposite me. It was a stalker. And some people may like that. It was kind of weird. I'd never felt comfortable, and I filed several complaints with the school about her. And finally, one day, I come out of my classroom to go to my night class, and I go to the elevator, go down, go to my class, and she follows me to class and sits outside the classroom watching that classroom. That was weird. 3 hours later, after class was over, I was met by the president of the university, the chief of police, and several counselors who said, "Ed, you were the last person to see her alive. She jumped out of the sixth-floor window and killed herself." What I wanted to do was drink. I had 6 months. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to go into my room, and I just sat there. "You can't even keep other people alive. What's wrong with you? Something's not right with you." And what I did was reestablish, retrace those steps that established my contact with a God of my understanding. I called my sponsor. I went to several meetings. I raised my hand. I shared. I got involved in the program. And I talked about what went on. I didn't understand it. I was numb. But I made it through. 6 years into the program, I was sponsoring people at that point, and I was working at a drug rehab, imagine. And my boss called me in one day and said, "Ed, you need to sit down." "What do you mean I need to sit down?" She said, "Do you know Ryan?" I said, "Yeah, I know Ryan. What about him?" "Well, he blew his brains out. He went to West Virginia, bought a shotgun at a yard sale, and got into a high-speed chase in South Carolina. And he swore, since he was under investigation for murder, that he would never be taken alive and never be sent to jail." And I didn't know what to say. Again, what's wrong with me? Why do I have this problem? I didn't want to drink this time. I just wanted to run and hide and run away and just isolate from everybody. I didn't know what to do. What AA said to me was retrace those steps that helped you establish your relationship with a God of your understanding. First things first. So everything that I wanted to do, I pushed aside, and I went back, I called my sponsor, I went to meetings, I prayed, I did everything I was supposed to do, and I made it through it. And ironically, 2 years after that, I was moving out of one sober house into another that was offered to me because my lease was running out on the one. And what ended up happening was the place I live in now is on the same street of the sponsee who killed himself. I didn't ask for that. And every time I drive by the house, I can't stop myself from looking at the house and just remembering. Wow. 2 years after that, I had gone back to school, and in sobriety, I managed to get my PhD in education. Thank you. Thank you. What my head wanted to do was my head wanted to, "Aren't I good? Look at me. I got my degree." And I was thrilled and excited. What I did was retrace my steps just so I wouldn't let ego take over, because it has a tendency to do that. And I went to a meeting, got asked to lead a meeting at Metropolis Club in D.C., I got up there and I told them I got my PhD, and they all kind of chuckled and said, "Ed, that just stands for poor, helpless, drunk. Don't get cocky." No respect, you know? What can I say? I called my sponsor and I said I got my PhD, and his response was, "Ed, that just stands for pig-headed and dumb. Shut up. It doesn't matter." No respect for my sponsor either. And in actuality, it doesn't mean anything except that I do what I'm supposed to do. I've been given a God-given gift of intelligence, and I need to exercise that and put that into practice instead of drinking it away. It kept me on an even keel so that I did not lose sight that my primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic. Wow, I really do have a purpose in my life. And that's what it is. 14 years sober. And I was working for the county in the prison system. And I got called in, and there was an accusation made to me about sexual misconduct. And I got fired. And I got put under investigation by the police. I got put under investigation by protective services. I got put under protective investigation. I don't know. There were five or six groups that were investigating me. And I called my sponsor. I said, I've got 14 years. How can I be fired? He goes, you beat me. I had 14 and a half before I got fired. What I wanted to do, I still think of it once in a while, is go back and flatten all their tires, blow up their houses. Crazy stuff. That's what my head thinks to do, is to get revenge on these people who fire me, because who the hell do they think they are? That's my crazy thinking. I didn't want to drink. I wanted to get even. But I was numb. I'd never been fired. Even when I was drinking, I was never fired from a job. Never. What do I do? 14 years, this stuff's not supposed to happen to me. What I learned was anytime there is a trauma or a significant special event, I need to retrace my steps so that I don't become spiritually dead. If I don't do what you told me to do, I will lose sight of my purpose and I will lose me. And I don't want to do that. First things first, as I said, means reconnecting those things that establishes the conscious contact. What I did was I just went to tons and tons of meetings. And I went into the rooms and I just sat there. A lot of times I wasn't even mentally in the room. I was physically just sitting there and I didn't know what to think. Because I had police calling me, I had counselors calling me, and all these different people were calling me on a regular basis. And I felt lost. I felt less than. And then what made it worse was a person in the program, who says they're in the program, got a copy of a tape where I spoke at a person's anniversary and told my whole story, and they took it to the Washington Post. And the Washington Post reporters start calling me and asking me if things in the story were true. My first reaction was, AA has betrayed me. No, it didn't. What the betrayal was one person who professed to be a member of our fellowship decided to let his perception and his old character defects take control. I didn't leave. I did what I suggest all of you do anytime there's a trauma. I retraced my steps. I went to meetings, talked to my sponsor on a daily basis. I stayed sober, and I helped another alcoholic. I kept reaching out and doing the things I needed to do because that's what you taught me. I'm still here. I've got 17 years now. It's been 3 years. I now have two full-time jobs. I'm an associate professor. I also have a real estate license. I teach all over the place. I do all kinds of wonderful things, and it's all because of you. Left to my own devices, I would have disconnected from you, trying to control everything myself, and I would have lost. Thank you very much. You know, that is just... I don't know what I did to deserve this, except stay connected with you. First things first, retrace those steps. There's one thing in chapter 5 that stands out in my head all the time. And that is, some of us try to hold on to our old ideas. Result was nil until we let go absolutely. I cannot obsess or stay connected to my old ideas. They all have to go. And my new idea, your new idea, is first things first. The miracle is that I'm still sober, And I'm still sober because you allow me the opportunity to come into this room and sit among you. For that, I'm truly grateful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. As he was talking, I was thinking back to first things first, when it first happened for me, and you know, I can remember that fateful day in September of 1989, when the first thing I just wanted was for the pain to go away. And it was still about me. I just wanted to end the pain. But by being connected with you people and doing the things that I needed to do, I had no clue I'd end up here today. And our next speaker, the committee here and the whole international went to great expense to bring to you. He's from Toronto, so they paid his way almost, I think.
Hi, I'm Danny. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Half Century Group in Toronto. But in actual fact, I was born in Montreal. So I'm called the Griffintown Irishman. I was unfortunate enough to not to be born there. We a little place in Montreal called Griffintown where the Irish immigrants came, and that's where I came from. And I came from a large family, 12 kids. And alcoholism was inherited in my family, of my grandfather and my father and most of my brothers. And none of my sisters, actually, thank God. There was enough of us with the brothers. But I started drinking when I was 13 years of age, and went to a buddy's house. He was babysitting for his uncle, and they had a bar, and I never was seen a bar in a house before, and anywhere where I was, that if they had a bottle in the house, somebody drank it. You know, it didn't sit around the shelf somewhere, you know, so. But we started sampling the booze, and that's the last I remember. I was sampling it, and then I woke up. I was in the basement of my house with a bicycle on top of me, and I'd driven 3 miles. So I had my first drunk, my first blackout, and my first drunk driving all in the same night, you know. So, yeah. So, actually, you know, I spent a lot of time in and out of jails. I never did any time. Thank God I didn't do any time. But I woke up in an awful lot of jails, and you know, and I was quite an international traveler. I was in jail in Rogersville, Tennessee, Knoxville, Tennessee, Atlanta, Georgia, you know, Cornwall, Ontario, and that was all before I was 16. So I was very fortunate in the fact that I ran into AA near the Columbia Ice Fields in the Rocky Mountains. In 1958, I got a job. This guy woke me up in the morning and said, we're going to work. I said, I don't want to work. I said, I'm going to Vancouver. And he said, no, come and get it. You got us jobs. So I went up to the place. We drove 102 miles up into the Rockies. And I told the guy, I said, listen, I've been on a drunk across Canada. I don't want a job. I want to go to Vancouver. This man needs a job. Would you please hire him? I get out of here. And he said, you stick around, I can use you. I thought the guy was a little nuts, but he wasn't. He was just a member of AA, and he was my first sponsor. So, but I was too young to be an alcoholic. You couldn't be an alcoholic at 21 years of age. You have to be longer. And I went out and I went back to Montreal. I went and got drunk again and again and again. And for 2 years, I tried to battle this disease, and I couldn't. I hit my bottom in Toronto, and that was in June of 1960, and I came up to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was not my last drink because I still had 3 years of battling the bottle. I stayed sober. I did all what you told me to do. I did everything. I went to meetings, but I still had this record playing in my head that I was too young to be an alcoholic. And one night in 63, I took another drink. I got another drunk and passed out, same thing as I did the first time. You know, I don't remember much about it, except I drank for a bunch of bit and passed out. And woke up in the morning when I said to my wife, is there any left? And she said, yes. I said, dump it, I don't want it. And to this day, I've never had another drink. And that was June 7th, 1963. But the thing is that my first meeting in Toronto, when I first came in, it was a discussion meeting. And I sat there, and when it was my turn to talk, it was a Monday night, I said, how am I going to stay sober this weekend? And the chairman, Jack, said, you're not next. And after the meeting, he said, unless you stay sober today. He said, how often did you drink? I said, every day, if I can get a bottle. And he said, okay, there's the answer. You have to go to a meeting every day. That's what you do. And I said, if you do that and you stay sober today, you may be sober on the weekend. And he says, if you don't do it, you will not be sober on the weekend. And he was right, you know. And I went to these damn meetings. For 9 solid months, I went to these meetings. And I said sober. But then I said, like, but that's fine. Every night you go to a meeting, but where do you meet girls? You know. And I said, you know, the only place I ever met a girl was in a bar. So what do? Well, I walk down the street and I tap some girl on the shoulder? No. You go to church dances. Well, now, is there anything in between? So the first thing I had to do was meet a girl. But the thing is that I have a philosophy, and I've said it back then, and I follow it today, to this day. And it's first things first. The first thing is me, is my sobriety. And that's what I did, and I took 9 months to do it. And secondly is my family. Third is my career. And fourth is service in AA. And if I keep those things lined up, then everything seems to work out. If I try to put one before the other, things get screwed up. If I put my career before my family gets screwed up. If I put service to AA before my career gets screwed up. And the thing is that I'm at this little girl, and you got to watch what you ask for in AA, because, you know, you're going to get it, but you're going to get a lot more. And all I wanted was a girlfriend, and I asked for this girlfriend, and I won her, actually. I won her. It was musical chairs, and I landed on her lap. And, so she was a little Irish girl, came off the boat, and she didn't know too much, you know, so. I went with her for 9 months, and then, we got married. And that's okay, and, so we changed a little bit, but a month later she was pregnant, you know. And I had that first little baby, and I held her in my hands, and an ugly little thing she was. So, and I thought, how am I gonna put her through university? I wasn't thinking first things first. And the thing is that she never went to university. You know. She's a super mom. She's a fantastic gal. And she's got 4 kids and she runs a company and everything else. And she makes more money than all the other kids that did go to university. I didn't know about them, you know. So I ended up with 5 children and I've got 10 grandchildren today. Thanks to you people. Because I'd never have made it without me. The thing is that as long as I keep my family, and that was, you know, a lot of times you're tempted to put the job ahead of the family, but the jobs come and the jobs go, and the jobs have never been. I've always planned. I made these plans. I'm going to do this and this and this and this and this, but the good Lord changes my course and says, no, you're going that way, you know. And as each child came, I had to work a little harder and a little harder and a little harder, but I couldn't. You know, it gets to a point where you can't work that hard. And then you have to start working smarter. And I had to work a little smarter. And I worked in this company and I worked myself up and I became foreman and general foreman of the company. And I had things planned out and things, money was good. And my wife was off in Ireland and visiting. And then a company was sold. And they came in on the Friday. They were taken over on the Monday. They came in on the Friday and said, we won't be needing you. There goes all my bloody plans, you know. And I was on the street. You know, I got to tell you, in 42 years or 45 years I've been in this program, I've been unemployed 3 weeks in that time. And I came in here with grade 7 education, not a PhD. but I am in real estate.
But the thing is that the where was I? Yes, I had this job and I got fired and I'm out in the street and I went looking for a job as a foreman. There's no foreman's jobs open, and I said, okay, I'll take a job as a pressman. I was in the printing business, and I said, no, you can't. You're overqualified. I said, well, now what the hell am I going to do? I work my ass off and I get promoted, and now I can't work. I can't go back down. I can't get a job. And the guy said it's very true. He said, listen, I'd love to hire you. But the problem is, he said, if I hire you and, 3 weeks later there's a job open for a foreman down the road, you're going to take it, are you? And I said, yeah, I am. I got a phone call from an ex-boss, a boss I'd worked for a few companies back. He said, Danny, I hear you're on the road. And I said, yeah. He says, there's a guy out in Weston. He's a partner in the printing business. I said, I don't have the money for that. He says, well, Luke, you go see him. And I went and seen him, and I ended up making a deal with this fella, and I went and bought into the company. And 2.5 years later, I bought him out, and I went on my own. I've never worked for anybody else since. But I had this all planned, and I had the company that I was going to run, and I had a house that was worth all kinds of money, and we hit the recession in the 90s, and everything went down the toilet, and everything was struggle, but I changed my career. But I none of these things were planned for me. They were one day at a time, and I did it. First things first. Just keep my sobriety, and everything else works. And then I ended up after my children grew up, I got into service. I did little service in the group, enough to keep me sober. But after that, I got into service in the committee level and Toronto Intergroup and general service. And that is where I really, really grew, because my group grew and grew and grew. And now, instead of having a small little group of people, we have thousands and thousands of people. And that's my group. You cannot do enough for AA. You can only try to pay back what was given to you. But my brother said, incidentally, we have 4 members of AA in my family today. My mother thinks that AA was invented just for her family. So she's 96 and still going strong. But the thing is, when you get in service, that's when you pay off, But my brother says it's like a bloody loan shark. The more you pay, the more you get, the more you owe. And you have to keep on paying it back. And I've been doing that. I've been trying to give back to AA something that was given to me. But every time I do, I get more benefit out of it than I've ever put into it. So one of the things that my group is very, very good at, and I love it, because I'm like a grandfather in the group, and they're very respectful of me. They started calling me Yoda. So I said to them, I said, what the hell is this Yoda thing? And they said, oh, he's an 800-year-old wise, wise man. And I said, oh, okay, that's fine. Yeah, but he's an ugly little fart. So they don't let me, they don't let my ego ever get too big, but one day at a time, they'll keep me on track. And I want to thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Again, first things first, and the priorities have changed so much in my life from the time I first got here and wanted the pain to go away. When with an extended hospital stay, the pain went away, but the mental anguish didn't leave. And the next first right thing I ended up doing was getting my home group in Belt, Montana, and getting a sponsor and getting firmly implanted in this fellowship. My home group, there was 6 people there when I joined it. And those 6 people, for some unknown reason, saw something in me that I could not see, because It was November of 1989 that I made that my home group. In January of 1990, they said, we need a GSR and you're it. And I've been involved in general service ever since then, too. So, but my priorities through the years of the first thing I do in the morning have changed over the course of the years. I learned to, on a first thing in the morning, to wake up and ask God instead of, you know, and I put Him first instead of me. But 3 years ago, my wife and I both, through this program, not through anything I did, had put in enough time in jobs that we were about to retire. And so, you know, we get paid for not going to work, which is an unusual thing. But now I find that in the mornings, on awakening, I ask God for guidance and go out and put on the coffee. And the wife gets up and does what she needs to do, and we go out and have a cup of coffee. And then I ask her what she'd like to do with the glorious day that we have ahead of us. And I find that if I follow guidance from God and direction from my wife, my life gets wonderful. It just, it goes places that I couldn't dream. So, our next speaker is Margaret.
Hi, everybody. My name's Margaret, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am from the Women's Thursday Morning Closed Step Study Meeting in Escondido, California. And I'd like to report that two of our members are sitting in the front row to keep track. And I'm amazed to be here. I am just totally amazed to be a sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know the topic for this meeting is first things first, and my sponsor has taught me from the day that I met her that what comes first for us in Alcoholics Anonymous is physical sobriety, and the way that we get physical sobriety is with HALT, and that's you don't get hungry, you don't get angry, you don't get lonely, and you don't get tired. And I'm all of those things right now, and... also, my friend Becky's in the front row. She moved away years ago, and it's just wonderful to hear her laugh because I know I'm okay. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous a long time ago. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that what we do at a podium is we share our experience, strength, and hope in a general way so that people can relate to each other. And first and foremost, I'm incredibly grateful to the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous for getting together, first off, and finding each other and being inspired by God and having the sense to write it down so that we had a book that tells us what to do. And I believe to the core of me that the book of Alcoholics Anonymous was written by God. He used Bill to put the pen to the paper, and the message is God's message. And I'm sober today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got here when I was 31 years old. I was a daily drunk. I couldn't get up in the morning without alcohol. I was single. I had bottles hidden all over my house. That doesn't make sense, you know. It made total sense to me. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was desperate. I had pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I totally understood that. It completely made sense to me. I knew I was in the right place when I heard that sentence, and it was never on my list of things to do to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was never what I was looking to be when I grew up. I didn't take a course in it in college. I had a dad that was a practicing alcoholic, and it looked really appealing to me. I mean, alcohol to me looked like what made you comfortable in your own skin. And for a long time, that's what alcohol did for me. But I'm an alcoholic, and so I want more. And And I was always the one that was the falling down drunk. I was the one that fell off the building. I was the one that, you know, that made a jerk out of myself all the time. And I was the one that my friend said, you know, Margaret, maybe you should try to not drink so much. And so the solution for me was to find new friends and made complete sense to me. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, like I said, in 1981, and the reason that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was because of Chapter 3. I didn't know what Chapter 3 was at that time, but I had tried everything else that I knew possible to try to make my life work, and I knew that alcohol was at the basis of all my problems. And I thought that if I could only stop drinking, that I'd be okay. And what I found was that I couldn't stop drinking. And so I went to a treatment center and I got physically sober. I mean, they got, God, what they do in treatment centers, I mean, if you ask them and they're honest with you, they told me that what they do is they keep you busy between Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I wanted something else to work for me. I mean, I did not want to come here and make a fearless and searching moral inventory of myself. I didn't want to make amends to people. I didn't want to do any of that stuff. And what happened for me, what my story is that my first day sober, I met who is today my husband. We met in the treatment center one day sober. And neither of us were married. Neither of us had ever been married. And we didn't have any kids. You have to say that today. You didn't back then. I met my husband in the treatment center, and we both were desperate drunks. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for about the first 30 days, all I did was just stay sober. And at 30 days sober, it was Christmas Eve, and I went to an Alcathon, and I was really feeling sorry for myself. I mean, that's pretty pathetic. You have to spend Christmas Eve in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And, I mean, I was just really feeling sorry for myself. And I heard a girl who I still know today stand up at the podium and talk about that if we did not have a fit spiritual condition, that there would come a day that we would be powerless over the first drink. And that scared the bejesus out of me because I knew to my innermost self that I did not have a fit spiritual condition. And I was scared to death that I was going to be struck drunk. And I think that that was a turning point for me. I really do. I use all these words like turning point and moment of clarity. And what I know today is that those are spiritual experiences. For me, they are. And I realized that I needed to do this thing. And so I think that that was the time that I finally decided to start working the steps. And I'd love to tell you that I worked all 12 steps and that I was done and that I was changed into this wonderful person and that I'm wonderful to my husband and my son. But that's not my story. But I have managed to stay sober one day at a time. One day at a time since the day that I got sober, which was November of 1981. And I've done it by doing the things that are suggested in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think that the very basis of that was to go to, in the beginning they tell you to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I went to probably 150 meetings in 90 days. And they tell you to get a sponsor. And I mean, I followed instructions, you know. What an amazing thing. I remember there was this girl that used to go to the meetings that I went to, and she didn't know how to cook. And she said she couldn't cook anything. She burned everything. And she came in one day, and she had this big plate of cookies. And she said, oh, my God, it's so simple. I just got a cookbook and I followed directions. And she said, and that's how it's been for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, the thing that to me is just so utterly amazing is that it doesn't matter what you're going through, there's always somebody that you can find that's been through it. And what I got taught in Alcoholics Anonymous is that there are a million people that will explain to you what they think you should do, and they will tell you their opinion about things, and they will tell you what you need to do and what you ought to do and what you should do. And what I found for me that works is that I find the person that's done it, and I go to them and I ask them how they did it and how they got through it and did they do it sober. And if they did it sober, then I try to follow their path. And so my sponsor's sitting in the front row. I have to say that because I love my sponsor, and she's been incredibly wonderful to me, and she's really, really led the way. And she sponsors probably 500 people. Right, Becky? And we go to the same meeting together every Thursday, and we go out to lunch afterwards. And my husband and I got married at about 2.5 years sober, and we went to our first AA convention in Montreal for our honeymoon. Isn't that romantic? And this is our fifth AA international convention, and we worked on the convention in San Diego. And I do a lot of stuff in our community. I'm real involved, and my husband is a professional, and he's still sober, too. He's talking in a meeting over in the South Buildings, and I think they had us talk at the same time so we didn't have to listen to each other. And we broke up at 18 months sober, and I just couldn't imagine how I could stay here and not be with him. Because, I mean, we were together everywhere, and I remember when we broke up, I called my sponsor, and I said, not this same sponsor, this is a different sponsor at that time. And I called her, and I said, well, I can't go, he's going to be there. And she said to me, you need to decide why you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. Are you here to be sober, or are you here to chase a man? And at that point in my life, I decided I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for me, and I went to that meeting, and oh, man, it was awful. But they were there for me, you know, the people of Alcoholics Anonymous were there for me. And I guess I ought to talk a little bit about this topic, which is first things first. And what I do in my life today is when I get up in the morning, I ask God to go with me. And it's really that totally simple for me. And my husband and I got married, like I said, right before the International Convention in 1985. And so we've been married we're celebrating our 20-year anniversary right now. And we have a 17-year-old son. And Andrew has never seen his mom or his dad take a drink. He has been brought up in a sober home, and he is a wonderful, wonderful young man. And that's all a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a gift to sobriety. And I can't remember if it was who said it, but somebody was saying that about what they didn't know what they did to deserve this. And you know, Where I come from, they use that phrase a lot, and I don't know that it's about deserve, because if I got what I deserved, I wouldn't be here. And Alcoholics Anonymous for me has been an incredible gift, and I think that we get it, or for me anyway, I got it from desperation. I got it because I was completely and totally demoralized, to the point where I said to myself, it is never, ever going to get any better my way, and I think I'd better try it another way. And that was my prayer. And I was 17 years sober, talking at a meeting, at a public information meeting, and my sponsor was sitting in the front row, And I was talking about how I had never had a spiritual experience. And I was telling my story. And I realized that my whole sobriety had been a spiritual experience. I had this overwhelming spiritual experience that my whole sobriety was a spiritual experience. And I don't know if I've talked long enough, but I think I'm done. So thank you for being here, and thank you.
Yeah.